all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
On Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit, you get information about foods you should eat to stay in good health and tips on how to stay active. I'm Josie Bidwell, host of Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit, an associate professor of preventive medicine at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Listen to the show every Monday at 11 or subscribe to the podcast by searching for Southern Remedy with your preferred podcasting app.
I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, and since I'm not in the studio this morning, we are re-airing some recent phone calls with your medical questions.
I get this question a lot about, you know, when we think about some of the main things to keep you healthy and whether or not you have chronic medical conditions. One of them, more common ones, is how much water should I drink in a day? Although it's a simple question, it may be complex depending on what kind of issues that you have. But generally speaking, if we talk about the entire population, you know, there was a campaign decades ago that said drink eight glasses of 8 ounces each a day, so 64 ounces a day of water. If you get more, you know, if you want to get really technical about that, you can calculate it out. But water is very important. It makes up about 70% of the body by weight, and it can be a little bit different depending on the constituents of the different tissues that you have, but that's sort of a general estimate of that. And it does lots of things. It can help you it helps to get rid of waste from your body through urination, through perspiration, through bowel movements. It helps with temperature regulation. A lot of tissues will not function without the presence of water. Every cell in our body has water as a component to it. It does protect sensitive tissues too. The brain, for instance, has cerebrospinal fluid that has water as a component. It's not the only component, but it sort of floats and with the little tethers to the meninges that help to hold it in place and to cushion it. So lack of water can affect all of these processes, and it can be small amounts over time or large amounts all in one sitting. So if you don't have enough water, that sort of dehydration is the general term for that. So the question about how much water do you need, if you're a man, typically it'd be about a little over 3.5 liters of fluid a day. So if you think about a 2-liter bottle of something, that's about 15.5 cups for men. It's a little bit less for women, so it's about 11.5 cups or 2.7 liters for women. But that's the recommendation. And we have to keep in mind that about 20% of the water that we intake comes from our food. So the rest comes from things that we drink. And water is certainly a great way to ingest that, just plain old water. But there's other things that you can get, you know, certainly other foods that have a lot of water content to them, like watermelon, spinach. They have a lot of water content. If you exercise more, particularly aerobic activities and the environment that you do that in, like outside, particularly in the South, that certainly you might need more water needs than that a day, depending on the activity and what you're doing. Your overall health can modulate that as well. So if you have a GI bug and you've got vomiting or diarrhea with that, you're going to lose more water than you normally would. So that may change how much of your water needs you need on a daily basis. Pregnancy and breastfeeding also, we talked about that a little bit earlier in a different context, but that can modulate that as well. And then there's all kinds of medical conditions that sometimes may limit the amount of water that you have. Chronic kidney disease, particularly if you're on dialysis, there are water restrictions for that. Congestive heart failure is another one. So there are some things that you definitely need to consult with your physician about that, about what the adequate amounts of water are. But generally speaking, though, if you stick to that 8 glasses a day of 8 ounces a piece, that's about the amount that you would need unless you've got some other restrictions. But that can help you stay hydrated and can certainly keep you going.
We're going to go to Tom and Brandon. Good morning, Tom.
Several months ago, I'd say about 3 months ago, playing golf, about halfway through the round, I found myself in what they call the rough, which is high grass.
I've been there many times.
Me too. And I swung a little harder out of that, and something happened to my hip. It didn't pop or anything, but it did hurt, and I could not walk straight. I had to limp and thought I was going to have to quit the round. And as I continued on, I limped for a few holes, and then it got a little better, and I was able to finish. But my question is, could that have been a dislocation? It's several months later now. I don't have any problems when I play golf. I don't feel it at all. But I walk in the mornings at a pretty quick pace, and I do feel it. It's not like a sharp pain, but there is a nagging sort of pain that is associated with it. Could I have dislocated that? And if I did, will it just be able to go back together without a problem?
Yeah, there's a lot of different things. That is that hip socket is a ball and joint socket, so it's a very tight socket. If you think about it in comparison to our shoulder, shoulder's not that. I mean, it's like a modified ball and joint, but it's not really a ball and joint because it has more mobility. So although the hip does give us mobility, it's sort of locked in there. So it's locked in there by tendons and ligaments, and those, depending on if you, you know, like you said, in a motion where you're you know, basically hitting out of the rough and probably just hit a little bit too fat and just sort of stuck through there, or it was a lot more pressure, those things can tear, and certainly they can cause a lot of problems immediately. If it's a tendon or a ligament, sometimes if it's a partial tear of it, they can heal up pretty good. Now, several different things can happen to make that joint dislocate, but it takes a lot to get it to dislocate unless you already have damage to it. So it would be very unlikely for it to be dislocated out of socket and then immediately come back in, just because that's, again, it's a tight joint. A shoulder can pop in and out all the time, and it's most of the time it's pretty easy to get that back in, depending on the person's laxity of those tendons and ligaments. But it's less likely, particularly with that motion, that you could have done that. Now, you could have torn like the labrum, so that's like the cartilage that that lines the bone between the femur, that's the upper leg bone, and the pelvis, that where it's in that joint space. Those don't heal up as well, and they usually are there for a while. So if you're feeling it later on, you may have a small tear there, or you might have a couple of things that happened all at once. I suspect it's probably just a tendon that was partially torn or a ligament. And those sideways movements, particularly as we get older, if you're not doing those, you know, and hitting out of the rough, I get it. The worst thing is, like, if a heavy rain and you hit something sort of fat, and I've done the same thing, and everything just stops. And that causes a lot of tearing to those, and a lot of pressure on those joints. But if it's okay while you're walking and you're still playing golf without any problem, if it's just a little bit sore, I probably wouldn't think anything was wrong with it. Best way to look at that, x-rays help some, but they only tell us about the bony parts of the joint. But an MRI would really show us the ligaments and tendons and all those cartilage surfaces. Most of the time, we can't just jump to the MRI just because it's expensive, and there may be other things that we can do first. But that's if it continues or if it gets worse, that's certainly something I would do to get it checked out. But my last question to you, Tom, is, did you make the shot?
I missed the putt.
I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, and since I'm not in the studio this morning, we are re-airing some recent phone calls with your medical questions.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. I've been diagnosed with a UTI by a nurse practitioner. Very kind and good, and I got a good shot of something in the tail, and also headed for today to get some antibiotics at the pharmacy. But I forgot to tell her that one of my symptoms developing over the last week or so, a little over a week, was not only the just frantic, instantaneous need to urinate, and I wouldn't make it to the toilet, or if I was outside, I could prepare pretty well if it wasn't too public. But I mean instantaneous, uncontrollable, no way to control it. It just would begin urinating. At the same time, however, I realized I was developing a bowel problem that loose bowels, not runny necessarily, not liquid, but very loose, accompanied by liquid. And it also was instantaneous and unable to be controlled. And that would be, I wouldn't be able to make it to a toilet. And so now I'm getting better, feeling better. And my fever was, I had a lot of fever. Don't have much fever right now. And so the antibiotic that I got shot with is working. And I'm getting less burning on urination and all that. So it's getting, I think, the antibiotic is working on the UTI, if that's what it is. But I forgot to tell her about this other symptom, and my question is, does that accompany a classic UTI?
Yeah, that's a great description, Roger, of some of the associated symptoms of a UTI. So UTI, for all those other people out there, means urinary tract infection. So that's anywhere in the urinary tract. So it can be from your bladder all the way up to your kidneys. And because of an infection is irritable to the tissues that are affected by it, it can cause spasms. And that's probably what's causing the symptoms that you're having. So we call that urgency, where you have this intense urge to relieve your bladder, and sometimes you don't make it. Same kind of thing can be happening with your bowels, just because those that's a pretty close proximity to the infection where it's happening. And most of the time, that gets better just with treating the infection itself. There are some medications that can help with that, but it's been my experience, if you start to treat with the antibiotics, within about 2 to 3 days, 4 to 5 at the most, then you usually see that urgency and that bladder spasm to decrease, just because you're reducing the infection. But yes, that can be a common symptom with a urinary tract infection, and usually you don't necessarily have to treat the spasm part of it, because sometimes those drugs can have a lot of side effects. Just treating the infection itself will make that better. But if it's not, you do need to call your physician or nurse practitioner back and say, "Hey, I'm having these other symptoms. I thought they were related to the UTI, but now I'm still having them."
You're listening to Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, but I am not in the studio this morning, so we are replaying some recent phone calls to the program.
Good morning, John.
Hello, Dr. Jimmy. I have been experiencing GERD for the past few years. I'm 74, but the only problem with my GERD is, I guess it was a problem, I do not experience any heartburn at all, but the acidic level is unbearable. I burp and belch all day long, and now have developed, just through my research on Dr. Google, is acidic labyrinthitis, and I'm extremely dizzy with vertigo. And I'm curious, what would be your remedy for it? I've taken Pepsi, and I was reading about Pepsi, and I also take cetirizine. And I guess those two are two drugs that will work together to as an antihistamine to help that. Do you have any solutions or suggestion as to what I can do, please, sir?
Yeah. So, GERD is one of those things that causes a lot of people some problems. And it can be a combination of sort of how our GI tract's put together, and it can also be other things too, even infections in your stomach. So if it's not getting better with either, changing the foods that you eat or changing the amount that you eat, sometimes if we eat too much at one sitting, all that has to, that pressure has to go somewhere, and sometimes it can come back up through the esophagus, and you get that sort of acidic taste, and it can either be in the back of your throat, as you mentioned. So we do treat it, you know, with medications to reduce the amount of acid in the stomach. So Pepcid's one of those. Things like Prilosec, Omeprazole, those are over-the-counter medications too that work a little bit differently, but pretty much to decrease the amount of acid. If that's not working after about 2 weeks, then you may need to see your physician about it, because again, there may be an infection with something called H. pylori. It's a bacteria that likes to live in your stomach, and it can interfere with the lining of the stomach in a certain way that acid can cause you more problems, even if you don't have classic symptoms of it. And one step from there would actually be seeing a GI doctor, and sometimes they have to go down with a little lighted scope from above down through your esophagus to make sure you don't have other things going on. Sometimes it can be problems with the esophagus and the way that it's working mechanically. Sometimes you could have a big hiatal hernia. So if it's not going away with the over-the-counter medications after two to three weeks or so, I would probably contact your doctor and say, hey, I'm having some bad problems here. They may want to treat you with some prescription medications to decrease that acid level a little bit further. But after that, it's pretty much, you know, testing for that infection and maybe even seeing a GI doctor.
Dr. Jimmy, I have gone through all those steps.
Oh, okay.
I have gone through the doctor at GI, and it's still persistent. I have had the upper GI. I've had the tests for SIBO. I've had all kind of tests. I've lost 45 pounds because I'm not able to.
Oh, goodness. Did they put you on like a prescription? Because Pepcid's good, but it's not quite as strong as some other things like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've gone through all of the P drugs, the Prilosec, the Protonix. I've gone through all of them. The Dexilin, I'm aware of all of them.
You named them all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. You know, the only thing I can think of is you may want a second opinion from a GI doctor just to see if there's anything else they can give you, because particularly with weight loss, because there are some GI doctors that sort of specialize in that area, and if they haven't looked for things like a hiatal hernia, they probably would have seen that and noticed that, but that may be something else that they might consider. Let's go to Caroline from Tuscaloosa, I believe.
And I am covered with basal cell. I've been treated for years. So I've had a lot of Mohs surgeries. My question is, my dermatologist in Tuscaloosa really wants me to be on the external chemotherapy. I tried it once, and I also have psoriatic arthritis, and I found that I just couldn't even function after 10 or 12 days. The fatigue was so extreme, and I didn't understand what it was until I looked it up and realized that you can get fatigue with the chemo. So my question is this: how serious is it? He really wants me to do the chemo again. And I really don't want to do it because I'm trying to work. I'm retired, but I still need to work. And how serious is it if I don't do the chemo and just treat one, you know, issue at a time?
Yeah. Yeah, there are some individuals for various reasons that may be more susceptible to getting those. You know, I mentioned earlier, they're in one spot. Of course, they can come back in the same spot, and after you've gotten one, you're at risk for another one, particularly in those areas that have more sun exposure. But in some individuals, and this may be a genetic cause, or it may be another reason, they may be on some another medication, like an immunosuppressive medication that's putting them at risk for that. We know that a lot of the medications we use for transplant, for instance, can put you at risk for multiple basal cells. Basal cell carcinoma, or squamous cell too. But basically, so chemo might be an option. I would just talk to him about it and say, okay, what, because they're going to have the numbers to give you to say, okay, if you take the chemo, it's going to cut down your risk by what percent? And if it's a large percent, maybe you do want to, you know, consider that, or a different agent if there is one available. And that's not an area I know enough about to tell you right now without reading further. But if it's only, you know, 5-10% decrease, then maybe that's a a good reason to not do it, as you stated, to just deal with the individual lesions that come up. So that's the way I would approach it if it were me, because I get it. I mean, you know, certainly if you're decreasing your risk, and that's probably what they're looking at as a bottom line. But if it's impacting your lifestyle where you can't do the things that you need to do, then that's may not be worth it.
Well, that's the way I feel, but I'm so accustomed to fighting this that it just seems like no big deal to have them cut out or burned out.
Yeah. It's almost like, you know, like you're a warrior or a knight, and you are being equipped to go out and fight a foreign army, okay? And and the armor, this being the doctor, gives you a sword that you can barely pick up.
Right.
Very useful if you can get it moving in the right direction, but it's not, you know, it's going to take a lot out of you. So it may not be, even though it may be a very powerful weapon for you individually, it might not be the best one.
Right. And I appreciate that because I just needed a second opinion. He's a great doctor.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I do the same thing. I'm like, okay, this is going to be very powerful. But the most powerful medication, if a patient can't take it for some reason, and that could be multiple reasons, it's ineffective at that point.
That's right. That's right. He had to shut me down the last time because I just couldn't even get out of bed.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would be very honest about that and just ask what the numbers are.
This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, but I'm not in the studio this morning, so it's a best of program. You're hearing some phone calls from recent shows.
We're going to go to Gail from Crystal Springs. Good morning, Gail.
Hi, good morning. My question to you is, I'm not a big water drinker in the mornings, and I take my pill and wait 30 or 45 minutes before I eat anything, but could I possibly take my thyroid pill with orange juice?
Yeah, I think that's so, you know, we've talked about like optimally what to do, right? So I tell my patients, okay, look, if orange juice works better for you, let's do that and let's see what the levels are, you know, on the blood when we check those after making a change like that. So, you know, 6 weeks or so.
Sure.
And if we're not given enough, and usually that's with a high TSH, we'll increase the dose. But generally speaking, you can overcome some of the interactions. Now, I certainly wouldn't be saying to people, hey, take your calcium supplement with levothyroxine or Synthroid. That's a bad idea because you won't get any or very little Synthroid in your body if you do that. But if you change from water to orange juice, I would say that's probably okay. And then we can check the levels and then we can make adjustments in the amount that you're giving. That's probably the best thing to do.
That's a great idea. And you might tell the lady that just called that I could not take the
generic. Yeah. Yeah, that's a common one.
My Medicare picked it right up. Problem.
Exactly. And that's why I said, you know, it's really important to check out which Part D is in dog plan that you have, because that is there are many out there and they're all a little different. And your pharmacist is going to be the person that can help you out. So if you just say, hey, you know, it's that time of year, I'm thinking about changing plans for next year, could you plug it in with X plan or Y plans? Or could you look at a lot of the pharmacists that are better at it to say, go to your pharmacy, choose the oldest person there and say, hey, can you help me out with this in person? And say, you know, I want to know if you can look at my medications and sort of find this out. Now, a few clinics, our clinics like this at UMMC that has our MedPeds clinic has it. We have a clinical pharmacist with us, and she always has pharmacy residents and students with her. So we have that resource in our clinic that can do that. But that's very common, is I'll say, hey, can you look at their medication list for me and to find out which plan might be the best one? But your local pharmacist has the same skill to do that, and they should be able to do it. But that they can help out, and like you said, you may find a plan that is just fine for your medications. But it, don't just tell them one medication. Tell them every medication that you're prescribed, because you got to think about the total bill, right?
That's exactly right.
Yep. Yeah, but that's good information. Yeah, I would say try it with orange juice, see how it works, and if the amount needs to be, the dose of it needs to be changed, that's what I would do.
This is Dr. Jimmy Stewart. Today on Southern Remedy, we are re-airing some of your phone calls from the last several months.
Good morning, Patty.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you, Dr. Jimmy.
Absolutely.
I have a question. I have asked two different dermatologists, and nobody has given me an answer. I get these little white, I don't even know, it's a waxy substance. It's very white, and they usually pop up around my eyes. And they don't go away. It's not like, a pimple or something, and it's not inflamed. And they won't go away unless I open the skin up and pop them out. And it's a kind of a hard, white substance. I don't know if it's genetic or if it's something with my diet, or I don't know what they are or what to do about them. No one has given me any answers yet.
Let me ask a couple of questions. So are they located more on the lower eyelid towards your nose?
Actually, no. I get them on my upper eyelid. I get them on the lower eyelid. I have one right now that's out towards the outer corner of my right eye.
And these are very small, like head of a pin?
Or two or three pins. But
gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, a couple of different things. Anytime somebody says waxy substance, there's a couple of things that normally it could be. And the right around the eyes and the nose, there's some glands that make sebum. And sometimes those can get plugged. Everybody has different size. You know, like we're different heights. We have different sizes to a lot of our pores sometimes. And it sounds like that's probably what's going on, these are getting plugged. Now, I don't know for certain, what those, again, dermatology is one of those things over the radio can be sort of a little dangerous, but you said you have seen a couple of dermatologists that have looked at that?
Yes, I've gone to the dermatologist mostly for other reasons, and then I'll say, hey, will you look at these things? Because they're really not, it's more of a cosmetic issue to me. You know, they just don't look good, and I've even had them up right under my eyebrow. So, I mean, they're not always, right near the opening of my eye, but a lot of times they are.
And nothing nothing along the hairline or around your ears?
No.
Okay.
Nope.
Some of the what you're describing sounds more like seborrhea, and it can, usually right around the eyebrows and eyes, it can cause some problems. Treatment is fairly simple with that. I'm going to say I would get one more dermatologist separate from your dermatologist to take a look at it, because if it's seborrhea, it's pretty easy to treat. And you can even use some over-the-counter stuff like selenium sulfide, which is in Celsin Blue. Maybe something that you may want to just use as a wash a little bit around that area. Be careful not to get in your eyes. But it sometimes, if that's what it is, that's an easy fix for it. But it's complicated enough in what you're describing that it may need to be looked at before you do that by another dermatologist. It doesn't sound, I'm not hearing any red flags that this is anything that's dangerous, but as you said, particularly around our eyes, I mean, cosmetically, that's a big deal.
Yeah, and most of the time they look at it, take a quick glance, and just say, oh, that's nothing. And I'm like,
Exactly. Say, oh, no. You have to name it. You have to tell me what that is.
Yeah.
At least,
I guess because I'm there paying for something else, you know, that they just kind of blow it off.
Look, one of the things that we as doctors do sometimes is we're looking for the things that are more complicated. Like the dermatologist is looking for basal cell carcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma, those kinds of things. And you're right. Sometimes we don't, and hopefully you don't have any of that, but it's just as important to say, oh, this is what that is. That's a hemangioma on your skin, and it's nothing to worry about. We can deal with it if you have a, you know, problem with it, but it may just be a capillary hemangioma. That's not what you have, but, you know, that's just an example. But yeah, I'd have them either name that.
I do have one of those also.
Yeah.
So I know what that
got
is.
A ton of those. But I think it may be worthwhile just visiting one more dermatologist to get their opinion and focus in on that. We're going to go to John from Mobile. Good morning, John.
I had a question about something that's really bothering me, really painful. It's during these winter months, I'm getting split skin and chafing, I mean really severe, on the palms and working on my palms and working surfaces of my fingers. And it's just not going away no matter what I do. You know, I use lotions and creams and even prescription creams. And it doesn't seem to go away. All I need to do is to, try to pick up, say, a loaded laundry basket, and whatever progress my hands have made in healing is undone right away. And right now, for example, I've got my, you know, some of the splits wrapped up in, what is it, Curad waterproof adhesive tape, which might work, but, you know, it looks kind of funny when you have all
right.
this stuff on your hand.
Right.
So I was wondering if you'd recommend a different course of action. Also, there's a product I know of called New Skin that you may have heard of, and I wondered if that would be helpful in covering these things so that they're not so extremely sensitive and painful and would last a day or two until I need to reapply.
Yeah, and this is a common thing that affects people during the winter months. So this most probably is dyshidrotic eczema. Now, you can have a couple other things that can cause this, but if it's in the winter months, this is a common problem that can happen on your hands. And as a type of eczema, really it's sort of a autoimmune, hyperimmune system problem. Where your body's ramping up its immune system in a way that's causing the skin problems and causing it to be cracked. The skin on our hands, particularly on the palms, it's what's called keratinized skin, and it's very thick. And it has to be that way because if you think about it, that interacts with more things, our hands and our feet, than any other part of our body on a repetitive basis. And it needs to be very, you know, if you put the same pressure that you put on the palms of your hands, on your arm, for instance, and had the same shear pressures and compressive pressures on it, you'd have problems. You'd have an ulcer or a tear in the skin there. And if there are any kind of disruptions to that, you can get a crack in your fingers, even like a cut or something like that. That can make it really hard that interferes with some of the processes we have. Now, normally that, you know, you've mentioned some of the things we usually treat with that, like the what we call emollients, and that's sort of the lotions or the creams that can keep that skin from drying out. And then the steroids, and there's several different steroid potencies that you can use. The problem, particularly on the palms, is that skin is so thick that it's hard for those medications and lotions to penetrate deep enough to where they have an effect, which is probably why you're talking about an occlusive, even like a glove. Like some people will put this on at night to try to heal this up and put the steroid on and then put a glove on top of that, like a waterproof glove. That may be something, the next step. And that way you're not walking around with it, you know, during the day looking like you've got, you know, like the mummy walking out of the pyramid. But that may help it penetrate at least during the daytime. Now, gloves can help to protect your skin from getting dried out, particularly if that's part of your normal routine at work or whatever you're doing. The drier it gets, and sometimes it can even be thermally related too, like to the cold, then that's going to increase the amount of problems that you have. One next step, I would try using some of those steroid creams at night or ointments, and then put it on first, and then just get you some plain old nitrile rubber gloves. You can get those at a hardware store or a pharmacy, and put those on at night and see if that doesn't help. Sometimes we'll do that for eczema too, and this sounds crazy, but for kids and adults who have really bad eczema, we'll tell them to take a tepid bath, not a hot bath, get out of the water, put on the prescription medication, and then wrap it in cellophane. But gloves would work great on the hands. That's probably the best way to do it.
You're listening to Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, but I am not in the studio this morning, so we are replaying some recent phone calls to the program.
What's your question this morning?
Have you heard of a... Now, they sell this at a vape shop. It's called HHC. It's supposed to take... It's a vape.
Uh-huh.
It takes the place... Supposedly it's legal. I don't know. You know, I just heard about it the other day.
So it's in the same family. It is a little bit different than THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana. But HHC is, it's a little bit different, but it is one that causes some of the same types of things, the euphoria that you have, you know, all the things that you can sort of get high on, it can do the same thing. The other question people ask about HHC is, will it show up on drug tests? The answer is, it can. So I'd be a little careful with that. So you can be impaired with it. It's not as, you know, CBD is the other thing that patients ask me about. And while CBD is unlikely, if it doesn't have significant levels of THC in with it, it's unlikely to, you know, cause some of the same symptoms of euphoria and that high that you get from THC. It can still test positive on drug screens too. So, HHC, I'd be sort of careful with that because I wasn't aware if it's, you know, legal to sell like that.
It's in the vape shops now.
Locally. Gotcha. There's no real evidence that it's any safer than THC either. So I'd be a little bit careful about
right.
that.
This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, but I'm not in the studio this morning, so it's a best of program. You're hearing some phone calls from recent shows.
Let's go to Rachel from Eupora. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Dr. Jimmy. And so my question is, does nicotine gum carry any of the risks that other tobaccos that you might use, snuff and chewing tobacco and that kind of thing?
Yeah, excellent question. So nicotine is a very powerful substance that, you know, I don't know a lot of people to get off of, you know, to sort of transition off of smoking. It's a very useful thing to do that so that you're not smoking and inhaling all the bad carcinogenic things that are in cigarettes. Or if you're trying to, you know, getting off of chewing or dipping. So nicotine in and of itself is not going to cause cancer. It's all the other stuff that's in there. But it can have systemic effects on your body. Depending on how much you're using, which is you always want to use, you know, nicotine gum comes in sort of a standardized doses of that nicotine. So you can sort of predict the delivery of it. But you want to start with the smallest dose that you can, or if you start with a higher dose, you know, after a few weeks, maybe cut the dose in half of what you're using, because it can increase your blood pressure. And if it increases it enough for long periods of time, then it can put you at risk for cardiovascular disease. But as far as cancer risk, though, I'm not aware of any studies that have shown that the nicotine gum increases your risk of cancer for oral cancers inside the mouth or lung cancer in and of itself. It's all that other stuff that's in there. But it's a really good delivery system for getting nicotine in your body. That's why it works so well. And that's why, you know, for smoking, certainly a great way to deliver that substance to the body. The lungs don't appreciate it, but if you're trying to get stuff in the body, that's one good way to do it. But it gets even more absorbed through that mucosa in your mouth. So that's why it works. But I would, if you're doing that right now and you're worried about, you know, you are noticing your blood pressure is higher, pretty easy thing to do. Just take your blood pressure about 15 minutes after chewing the gum and you can probably see an increase in it. Then you may want to cut the dose down to the lowest dose that you have, and then hopefully wean off of it over time. We're going to go to Terry in Tupelo. Good morning, Terry.
Hey, Dr. Jimmy. I just wanted to give you a success story. You only usually hear about the bad things and never get to follow up and hear about the good things.
All right.
So I had talked to you about a month ago, and I was scheduled to have, there's a big word for it. There's also initials. But what it amounts to is they take the disc out of the C5, C6, and C7.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, what is that? There's an acronym, AD something other, but anyway.
You know, I have to look it up too. I'm not a surgeon, so it's, I just refer to it as a discectomy. So basically they're taking the disc out and they're probably stabilizing the spine, but it does have a long acronym. You're right.
They are. And, man, I'm telling you, it's like I got a new lease on life.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. You know,
when you beat a mule long enough, I guess I get used to getting a beating because my arm was so tight, but I didn't really realize it. And after the surgery, my whole arm just relaxed.
Yeah, that's
my left arm.
I'm glad you had that outcome, Terry. And it's interesting. Like, I think when we talk about spinal surgery and back surgery in particular, lower back surgeries can have a lot more complications, but usually in the neck, it's actually, you would think it would be a harder place to get around and to do what you need to do from a surgeon standpoint to relieve a lot of that pressure on nerves or to stabilize the neck. It's actually a better outcome with neck surgeries. And some people are scared off a little bit because the access tends to be from the front. So they actually go through the front of the neck and make a small incision to do that. But most of the time, with a good surgeon at the helm, knowing what they're doing and have a lot of experience, this is the kind of response that you see. And you're right. Sometimes we go through a lot of pain and we're like, you know, I just don't think I'm going to get any better. I'm sort of used to this. And then you really don't know until you have that surgery how impactful that can be. And Terry, what was your recovery like? Was it like a pretty sudden, or did you have to do some physical therapy?
No physical therapy. I didn't even wear a neck brace. The biggest issue that I had was my traps in my shoulder were sore.
Yeah.
And that soreness has now subsided.
Yeah.
But I have to give a shout out to Dr. Jason Stacy. He was the surgeon that did this. And it's funny you mentioned the scar. It's about 3 inches. And I asked the nurse, I said, you know, will this scar stay on my neck? And she said, well, if you put vitamin E on it every day. And I said, no, you don't understand. I don't want to lose the scar. Chicks dig scars.
that scar may turn into a different story. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
You should see the shark.
That's right. Got me on my neck. You should see what happened to him. Well, Terry, thank you for calling and giving us that success story. You're right. It's always good to hear that, and it might encourage some of our other listeners to pursue that pathway if they're having some neck and shoulder and arm pain or weakness.
We're going to go to Susan in South Haven.
I have a question about blood oxygen levels. Last year, I bought an oximeter because it was supposed to be a better way to see if you were developing COVID than temperature or other symptoms. what's happened is the weather's gotten hot and humid. I wake up in the morning and I feel great, and then by afternoon, I'm having trouble standing up straight, and I'm exhausted, and I just fall asleep. So out of curiosity, I checked my blood oxygen level when I woke up this morning, and it was like 98, and my heart rate was about 60. But yesterday when I checked it, when I woke up from one of my afternoon long naps, my blood oxygen level was fluctuating between 92 and 94, and my heart rate was 70. Is there any way I can get my blood oxygen level up?
It's pretty easy to get an oxygen monitor. We call those O2 sat monitors, or saturation, and they use a certain wavelength of light when you stick your finger in there to calculate how much percent of oxygenation of your blood there is. So there are some limitations to those. We had one of our patients that bought one, and she said, my oxygen saturation is 60%, but they were talking in complete sentences and weren't short of breath. Well, they were taking it through fingernail polish, so it doesn't work that way. So you have to have, you know, clear views all the way down, even if somebody tells you differently. But in your case, I would say this is normal from an oxygen standpoint. So our bodies only need about 90 to 92% of the blood saturation to adequately transport oxygen. Now, of course, if you have other things going on like chronic lung disease or heart failure or pneumonia, you mentioned COVID. One of the complications was, you know, it can be lung infection. All of those are reasons why your O2 saturation levels can decrease. The variations that you described in both heart rate and in oxygen levels are normal throughout the day. We tend to have lower pulse rates first thing in the morning, and they go up during the day. And humidity doesn't really change the oxygen content in the air that we breathe, nor does heat appreciably. So that really doesn't affect that. What it does affect, though, is how hard your body's having to work because of that excess heat. The best way is to condition yourself, just like an athlete would, to utilize the oxygen that's there. And the reason why your heart rate may be going up is because your body's having to work harder, not because it's getting less oxygen levels, but because downstream at the muscle layer, it's not conditioned enough to do that. And if you think about it, this makes perfect sense. If you take a high school person who's never run a race, and they suddenly are training for a race and on the track team, the first time that they start to run, they're going to be a whole lot more short of breath. They're going to breathe a lot faster. Their heart rate's going to be higher. As they train, they're really training their muscles how to utilize oxygen better and how to utilize energy better in different systems of management of that. And as they train, their heart rate's going to come down, and also their respiratory rate's going to come down. But the O2 levels you mentioned are perfectly normal. 92% is in that normal range. Even if it gets down to 90, sometimes that's fine. But it's not really modulated from an oxygen standpoint by heat or humidity. But that does make your body work a lot harder during those times. From an exercise standpoint, you lose a lot more. You have to exert a whole lot more energy, as you said, in the summertime than you do in the cooler months. So that's sort of a physiologic explanation for that. O2 monitors, again, good things. You just have to know what they're useful for, what they're not useful for. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, professor of pediatrics and internal medicine at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Southern Remedy is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio, and funding is provided in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center and support from listeners just like you.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.